You're back to Liquid Sound. I'm your host, Gintaras. Next week on Liquid Sound, if you've been tuning into the show every week, you've realized that the schedule has been pretty erratic, and the reason it's been pretty erratic is because I underestimated how erratic people's schedules would be in the summertime. But rest assured that Liquid Sound is attempting to get very exciting guests for next week and beyond, including jazz players. I've recently found myself in conversations with jazz players, with some of whom are very well known here in Chicagoland and in New York City. Jazz players who are interested in potentially speaking to me here on Liquid Sound, so keep tuning in for that possibility. As always, I announce my guests on my Gintaras Facebook page. That's Gintaras, G-I-N-T, and the surname is A-R-A-S, on Facebook. So if you find me there, you'll have the announcements for Liquid Sound. And you can also find me on Twitter, hashtag Gint_Aras, G-I-N-T_A-R-A-S, at Twitter. Now let's get back to the interview with Robert Duffer. Robert Duffer, if you're just tuning in, is a Chicago area freelance writer and college professor. We have been discussing his professional strategy as a freelance writer and what a student should do if he or she wants to get in through the door.
So see who's doing what, and then, you know, of course, the thing that'll get you in is if you have a good idea. Mm-hmm. And you know who to talk to. So what is the idea? Don't just say, I want to write about dodgeball. Mm-hmm. So what? What about dodgeball? So if there's like a dodgeball tournament, if there's a dodgeball tournament coming up, and it's like the world, and they do have like a world champion of dodgeball.
Sure.
Because every little quirky thing has an organization.
Yeah, turtle races.
Turtle races.
Yeah, yeah.
And magazines love these esoteric, quirky, weird stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So don't just say, I want to write about dodgeball. Say there's, you know, on February 28th, the annual dodgeball tournament comes to Chicago, mm-hmm. featuring...
Mm-hmm.
Lady Amazon,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
who's whatever. Mm-hmm. And you research it, and usually what you'll find with freelancing is you put in a lot more work pitching and not hearing back and also researching the story, and then once you start to build your platform, editors will start coming to you because
mm-hmm.
you've demonstrated your competency.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest thing is distilling your idea into something that is clear and concise, because that is not only how you're going to help the editor do less work, but it's also going to be your writing sample.
Mm-hmm.
You might, especially if you don't have clips at that point.
And when you talk about the writer doing less work, this is something that I hear students saying all the time. Students who want to become writers, they say, well, I don't actually have to learn how to control the language. That's the editor's job. The editor goes in there and rewrites everything that I write because the editor has 80 hours a week to rewrite what I have to write. Hey, what do you have to say about that?
There's a lot of misperceptions about the roles of writers and editors. Editors are probably the busiest people I know in mm-hmm. terms of taking on other duties, especially with in magazines having double print and digital updates to make.
Mm-hmm.
When an editor hires a contractor or hires any writer or agrees to work with them, they're doing it under the impression that this writer is going to do a job that they don't have to put much work into.
Mm-hmm.
So they can devote their resources to the other things the magazine needs to get done.
Mm-hmm.
If you write something that has any grammatical mistakes mm-hmm. or needs a ton of fact-checking that you didn't fact-check,
mm-hmm.
they're not going to hire you again
because
mm-hmm. it's a waste of their time.
Yeah.
If they have to rewrite it, now, they're going to, you know, the best relationship, the reader does an awesome job with
mm-hmm.
a freelancer-editor relationship. They go back and forth four or five times on a rewrite, mm-hmm. if not more. But they're devoting a lot of time to that,
mm-hmm.
To making something good, and it's a wonderful experience. But if they have to keep doing that, and you're like, no, this smiley is a precious word and I want to keep it, they're not going to want to work with you again. And that's like, I mean, that's just true with anything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The bigger pain in the ass you are, the less people are going to want to work with you.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're giving something that is so spectacular, it can't be had anywhere else.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is what you should aim for, of course,
mm-hmm.
but you also have yeah. to be conscientious at least of other people's, what their work demands.
Yeah, there's a professionalism that goes along with it, right? You, if you're making assumptions that it's someone else's job to fix my errors in any profession, you're an idiot.
you're not going
to
do well.
Yeah, there's really very little, there's no way to sugarcoat that one. The reason we're talking about that is because that's something I hear very often in the classroom, is that I don't really need to learn this because someone else will take care of it.
Well, and where does that mentality come from? Like, in any endeavor in mankind, mm-hmm. where do you get away with that? Mm-hmm. Like, imagine a parent, we're both parents, imagine me being like... I just kicked my kid, but it's all right. Someone else will take care of
it. Someone will put the band-aid
on my kids, right?
Yeah.
It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, yeah. Or the fireman who thinks, well, I don't really need to learn how to use the axe. I'll be specializing in hose, so I just need to learn hose. And all you need to do to learn how to use the hose is hook it up and turn it on and point it, and that's it. And, all right, where is my paycheck? You know, that mentality exists right now in the generation that we're dealing with. That we'll talk about your work as a teacher. I see it quite often, this just idea that I don't really have to learn anything. I just need credentials.
Well, and my brother teaches at a suburban high school, and we traveled together. He was a chaperone. We traveled together in Europe over the spring, which was a great experience, but one of the things that we talked about, and this isn't meant to be offensive to students of any kind. It's not easy being a student. There's a lot of challenges that go with it. But one of the things that we were worrying about was that we're teaching, due to standardized testing and other things, mm-hmm. we're teaching a generation to follow orders, to follow instructions. Do this and you get this. Mm-hmm. Instead of teaching a generation to think, mm-hmm. to solve problems on mm-hmm. their own creatively, mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's a United States problem. I don't know how widespread it is, mm-hmm. but it's apparent. This idea of being able to problem solve is essential in anything, mm-hmm. and I don't know. I think that's missing in a lot of what's being taught, mm-hmm. and I don't know if you see it at the college level.
Oh, of course I do. Yeah, we see it all. That's the most common conversation that I have with my colleagues. The conversation that you had with your brother is the conversation we have. And what we're dealing with is a pool of students that have come out of a high school system in which they've been taught assumptions about reality that are just false. That you have to pass me because your goal or your job is to manage my emotions or something. And no, that's not it. It's not an employer's job to manage your emotions either. They're interested in you performing something.
Well, and the equivalent too is I did the things that were listed on the syllabus.
Yeah, yeah.
Why aren't I getting an A?
Yeah, yeah.
Because you didn't do them well.
Yeah.
There was no thoughtfulness that went into them. There were checklists. Mm. I mean, you see it so many times when you go to a business where there's teens employed.
Yeah, yeah.
And you ask them a question. What is the problem that the person is having? Mm-hmm. Not what is the thing that they're asking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But like if they're asking, like we were at this place the other night, and they had three taps of beer. Mm-hmm. And the one of them was Leinenkugel's, the other one was Light and MGD. Mm-hmm. Now, I knew that Leinenkugel's couldn't have been, like they don't get much traffic. It's mm-hmm. a food place. Mm-hmm. So I asked the team working that, now he's not going to know about beer. Uh-huh. I understand that, but I say, how old is that Liney's? Mm-hmm. How long has it been there? Mm-hmm. Is it going to be nasty? Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, I don't know. Now there's a dozen ways that he could have resolved my concern. I mean, sell me a $3 beer, right? Just make a sale. Just tell uh-huh. me, open a tap and let uh-huh. me see it, maybe. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Or just ask the guy working next to you, the mm-hmm. older guy. Mm-hmm. Be like, hey, what, you know, does this get much traffic? There's, mm-hmm. I mean, there's just, like, the, I don't know.
And then, but what's weird about it is, that means I'm done, right?
Right.
Well, I don't know, I'm finished.
I don't know.
There's nothing else to do.
There's not, don't find the answer to the question. Just be like, it's not me.
Yeah.
It's beyond me.
Yeah. The editor will take care of that.
Right, the editor will take care of it. The teacher will tell me what I did wrong.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about teaching. Faculty member at Columbia College, Chicago.
Adjunct. I'm an adjunct.
You're an adjunct faculty
member. Part-time.
Yes. What courses do you teach, and what's that experience like?
I'm currently teaching the writer's portfolio. This is summer session, which is it. This is the last week. Mm-hmm. I love teaching that class. It's for graduating seniors. It's a capstone course for the bachelor's in fine arts. It's a requirement. Essentially, what students have to do is look back over their 4 years of writing, both in their major studies and their gen eds, and articulate what they've done that's marketable that translates into a job skill. And there's a lot of it. So that's one side in terms of thinking about it. And then they develop, of course, a resume. Mm-hmm. And then they develop a print portfolio and a web portfolio, mm-hmm. Amassing their best work that shows their broadest range to prospective employers. It also shows their writing competencies and their sort of aesthetic design ideas. Mm-hmm. And then throughout the semester, they have to do three dream job interviews. So they identify the type of jobs they'd like to have, how to go about getting them, and then they actually interview a subject who has that job or a job similar to it.
So this is a practical skills course as well.
It's all. And then we do three critiques. Mm-hmm. Of their work that they're going to post on their website, and then also the intention is to submit it to markets. They do a pitch, they do cover letters, resumes, queries, the dream job interviews. It's a really fun class because there's so many different things going on every week, and a lot of it is feedback. So, like, we'll put their resume up, and it's in a smart room, which has a projector and a internet connection. So we'll put their resume up on the wall, and then the 10 of us will critique it. We'll be like, well, this makes sense. This doesn't make sense. We do that with their creative work. Mm-hmm. We do it with their website. We do it with their print portfolio. So by the end of the term, they have a solid, they have something to show people. Mm-hmm. And throughout the term, there's all these different and weird varying successes in a good semester.
Sure, sure.
A student last semester got an internship at Akashic Books, which was her favorite press, and she was from Brooklyn, and it's out of Brooklyn.
Yeah, yeah. I know the press well.
Yeah, yeah. And she was elated by it. And then she got a job working for two other places, locally in Chicago, when she came back from the internship. So there's, like, all these success stories, which is wonderful, and it's just a matter of being able to take everything you've done and identify who would want you, and how you go about showing that. So it's branding and promoting self-promotion.
Yeah. It's also self-analysis, which is interesting.
Yeah, and it's for some people that have been doing the bare minimum, it's very hard to be able to finally look in the mirror and be like, all right, what have I actually done? Mm-hmm. And the students that are committed to their major, are committed to doing this as a career, the class really acts as sort of a career bridge. It's a bridge between academic and their career. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it in the right way, anything you're doing as a college student should or could be feeding your career. I mean, your career is starting in college, potentially. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know anyone.
Your career starts when you make a decision about what college you're going to go to.
And also what you want to do, which it changes for all of us. Mm-hmm. But all of it feeds the other thing, no matter how disparate it is, whether you study econ and get an MFA. It still feeds what it is that you want to do, your understanding of the world and your place in it. And yes, deciding on a college. Mm-hmm. And then on the other end of what I teach is creative writing workshops. So there's, like, the core sequence in the fiction department. There's a creative nonfiction course that I teach, which I really like, too. And then there's critical reading courses. There was a fiction and film course that I taught once. And then there's a publishing class that I started off co-teaching. So that's kind of the thing I like about teaching, too, is that there's a lot of different things I can be teaching. And every core writing workshop requires and demands a lot of reading of student work, but also for students to be reading published authors as well as their own work.
And when I teach courses like those, I always find myself guiding students to reading materials, right? Students who display an interest in something. I say, okay, you need to read these six authors, you know, the complete works of. And it'll help you.
So a lot of the stuff that I do applies to many different ages. I'm actually considering getting state certification to teach high school as a job, because I don't know what's going to happen in the coming years.
Yeah, speaking of, let's talk about that. What's going on at Columbia College? You've been publicly critical of Columbia College in your column in the Examiner and also in other places on the internet and Facebook and such. What occurred at Columbia College that upset you so much, and why are you still upset?
All right, so for a year, there was talk of something called prioritization, and all the full-time faculty and administrators had to fill out copious forms analyzing their department and what it was worth, and if it was sustainable, and what sort of predictions they can make for the future. Mm-hmm. So what the college did was hire an outside company to tell them where they can cut costs, mm-hmm. which in and of itself seems counterintuitive, and it also seems like the blame should lie mm-hmm. if you can't figure out what's mm-hmm. what the problem is with your own company. Mm-hmm. Maybe you shouldn't be running it.
Yeah.
So there was, you know, for six to, I don't know how long it was, for about 6 months, maybe a year, there was all this unspoken tension. Mm-hmm. Everyone was super busy. I mean, the full-time faculty I actually feel bad for. They do a great job, but they're on all these committees. They got all this other stuff to do that their other duties are teaching, and then the writing. So this was going on, and no one was really saying much. There was speculation, and the administrators were promising that nothing would be implemented until the prioritization process was done. And then one Friday night in the spring semester, we get an email from the dean of the fine arts school. So they email the faculty in the fiction department at like in the evening on a Friday and say that the chair, Randy Elbers, who has led the department for 16 years, his contract wasn't going to get renewed. Mm-hmm. His contract was supposed to be, he was expecting it to be renewed for 3 years. That was what he was told in the winter. Mm-hmm. And then we found out that the English department, Ken Daly, his contract wasn't renewed. Mm-hmm. So these were obvious changes mm-hmm. that were going on, despite what they were saying, that there were going to be no changes until they finished this process. Mm-hmm. So there was a big kerfuffle. Mm-hmm. And yes, I wrote something about everything that Randy's done for the college to raise the profile with initiatives like Story Week and Creative mm-hmm. Nonfiction Week, and also, I mean, the department's grown so much under his leadership.
Well, but not just the department, but he's a fixture in the Chicago arts community. Yes. I mean, this is someone who has had a hands-on, very direct mm-hmm. influence in the Chicago literary scene, which is one of the biggest ones in the country.
if you could take a handful of people that were most instrumental in creating the current literary community in Chicago, he would have to be mm-hmm. one of the top.
Probably, ones. Yeah, within the top three. I'd say.
Just and he's always so supportive of. He's done wonderful things, and for him to get let go in that manner was a slap in the face to everyone, and mm-hmm. it was really an embarrassment on the college. Mm-hmm. And they, 2 weeks later, acknowledged it mm-hmm. by re-signing his contract for another year until this prioritization process was complete. And some of the things that they're talking about, merging the fiction department with the English department and calling it a creative writing mm-hmm. department, mm-hmm. makes a ton of sense. Mm-hmm. Cutting costs makes a ton of sense. Mm-hmm.
What's great about the story is that sure, the college came out and handled the situation in this addle-brained way, but then suddenly there was an uproar among, and it was almost categorically everybody who was involved said, this is just awful. In the press, and on the radio, I mean, wherever, you know, Facebook, all over the place. And the college said, okay, I guess they screwed.
Fucking doesn't matter. They had to suffer up their asses.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, the things outside of the fiction department, I really can't speak as much to them, but they shut down the Black Ensemble Theater, which was another Chicago fixture.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, one of the reasons that those properties, that South Loop area, mm-hmm. the Michigan Avenue, where you have the Art Institute, going from the Art Institute down to Roosevelt and Columbia, and then even down to East-West University, that whole strip, that whole area, DePaul's over there, Columbia has grown massively mm-hmm. big. They're mm-hmm. like at 11. They were at 12,000 at their peak. Now they're at like 11,000 student enrollment. This is up from essentially what was a commuter college.
Yeah, 4,000.
Right.
When I was going to UIC, it was about 4,000 students.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's had tremendous growth because it has had a successful model. And now because of all these properties that were bought up, the model is changing. Mm-hmm. The enrollments have finally plateaued along with the economy. And
well, let's be clear. Because of all the money lost on these properties that have been purchased, that's
and again,
key.
I can't say that as fact, but
well,
that,
come on.
That is clearly where the speculation is.
That's got to be it. There's, I mean, I own a condo that I paid $130 for and that is worth probably $60 at this point. That's in downtown Oak Park. These are Michigan Avenue properties. Okay, these are South Loop properties. I just can't see that place being a massive exception.
So they were cutting I think that once the changes do go into place and they're done in a thoughtful, open way, mm-hmm. They'll have the support of most faculty and mm-hmm. most students. It's mm-hmm. going to make the college stronger. I'm certain of that. It's just the manner in which it was done mm-hmm. was idiotic.
Well, let's talk about your novels. A Place to Call Home is the first novel you wrote. Excerpts of it were published in a variety of literary magazines. Mm-hmm. Right? And currently you're working on a novel called The Affairist.
Yes.
Which, it's in progress, right? You're on, what, the third draft or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You're going to read something from The Affairist for us today. Let's hear what you have to read from The Affairist.
Okay. This man who's unemployed and been lying to his wife about it has been going downtown, taking the commuter train downtown every day to go to a job that he doesn't have. And since he's been doing that, he's noticed at his train station this woman who is having an affair with another man, and it aggravates him. So Lyle is his name, and he is now following her onto the train. As he followed her legs up the steps to the train, her black Gucci boots with a small gold buckle, a boot shaped to the calf with an improbable heel and an even more improbable cleanliness to them, it's winter. An impulse struck Lyle. Smack her ass. Not even smack, just wedge his hand hard and swift between her pinstriped thighs, give her a little pop, and watch her flush. In high school, you could drive the wedge in a girl, wink, and she'd hate you to her friends even as she accepted your invite that night to make out wherever they used to make out, but that was other guys, never Lyle, and never now. He continued through the vestibule into the P car with the bathroom. Maddie loved the 4 car, too. Maddie is his son. Begging to be held up to the front window so he could watch the city suck up the steel licorice rails. By himself, Lyle took the other car on the way home. He ascended the stairs to the single seats on the second level, following her snow-capped beanie as it glided, never bobbed, down the aisle to her seat, always third seat from the front, always placing her bag on the outside for her man. He folded his newspaper in his lap so no one could see him watching her down through the luggage rack. How had he not noticed the driver before, or the wedding ring, which was now being dropped into her purse in the same motion that she took out her cosmetic bag? The train started moving and she started fixing her face. Head off, twisting her candy wrapper ponytail and smoothing her sunburst hair, then making taut the loose lines in the forehead, the subtle sags around the eyes. Then the eyebrows exaggerated with a point, the eyelids stretched and dabbed, the mascara faded lighter at the corners, the entire application and art of subterfuge. Accentuating your features without calling attention to the accentuator. The Affairist, that faker, clicked shut her compact and adjusted in her seat. The woman 3 seats behind smirked at each other and rolled their eyes. How could she cheat on him, Lyle wondered. How could she enjoy him and another man? And how could he be loved like that? Not to the world, but to his wife, who very soon could be treating him with the same cold indifference as all the other hey buddies in the world. Hey, buddy, we lost our house because of you. Hey, buddy, you lied. Hey, buddy, you failed at being a man. She was on to her last step, the vigorous and thorough rubbing of the hand lotion. Could smell it up here. Peach or vanilla. He had to find out what kind so he could buy a bottle for Shelley. It's his wife. Valentine's Day, maybe. Good morning, passenger. It's the changing of the card, the conductor said, striding in from the vestibule. He went to the front of the car and worked his way back, starting up top. He looked at Lyle, nodded, but did not punch his ticket. It had happened before, and Lyle figured he looked like anyone else. And if you look like anyone else, then you look like no one. Maybe he expected something of Lyle. February tickets, it's February, longest month of the year for Chicagoans. And I'm going to jump ahead to her point of view. Where would Gary take her for their marriage maintenance weekend? Gary is her husband. He'd prefer his family's cabin in the woods, but she needed some sun. Maybe she could suggest an island, someplace warmer for some time longer, find out when Stephen's kid had spring break. Then he could go with his family, she could go with Gary, then they could slip away in the hotel's fitness center, or rendezvous on a grocery store run, or a little morning sex walk on the beach. Terrible thoughts. Thoughts of Stephen, her little pieces of chocolate. Too much and you'd get fat. But she'd be nearing his slice of suburban heaven soon, so she could have one little piece. There was the steeple over the canopy of elms. Then there was the 2-block walk southwest of his house, the long porch with a rocker and a porch swing, the evergreen-colored shutters on the ash-colored siding. She hated that his house was cute, though it was not without room for improvement. That black shade in the uppermost window. Which daughter lived up there? Did he have a little goth running amok? She could never ask, because he could never know that she dragged her husband to her lover's neighborhood under the pretense of some famous hot dog joint. Can't believe she did that. Stalking and deceiving in one trip of whimsy to both of her men. It was the anticipation of seeing Stephen, of spending Thursdays with him, that caused this greed of affection in her, her cravings. And it was this greed that ruined things, no matter the rules. She made a heart-shaped lip line on her coffee lid and took a sip. Her hands were shaking. She sat on her thumbs. It was embarrassing how excited she got. She used to sit on her hands in college to make sure she wasn't getting fatter. As a co-ed with her legs crossed, she could fit her hand between the edge of the chair and the outside of her thigh, legs crossed. Over the course of a semester, she watched some girls' asses pancake over the seat, a growing flapjack of thigh batter, and now she measured her thighs again, fitting her left hand to the wall side of the seat and her right hand to the seam that split the seat in half. She couldn't flatten them, could barely keep them in the confines if she stacked her hand vertically. God, she was so disgusting. The train was slowing. She looked out the window at the sea of strangers. "Excuse me." Lyle sat down as she moved her bag. He had planned on sitting on it. Oh, an ugly face. Her eyes like icicles. Smells like her coffee. Cinnamon, hazelnut, muffiny. Maybe this was a bad idea. "No, excuse me, the seat is taken." "Oh," Lyle said, fidgeting with his empty attaché and peering out the window. "I thought he didn't come on for another stop." She dropped her coffee. It hit off the instep of her Gucci and spurted onto Lyle's pants. He picked it up and handed it to her, a trickle of mild, sticky coffee on his thumb and forefinger. The lid had stayed on. Her eyebrows were raised, her eyes laughing, the muscles in her jaw clenched in menacing. "This seat is taken. Move, please." "It's a public seat," Lyle said. "As public as your adultery." Where did this guy get off? Where did he get on? Not here. The train had just stopped. Why was he sweating? How long had he been watching her? What was with that ear hair? "Move now, please." They were speaking in a whisper. She was shifting her things. "So you're not going to move? Why are you..." "Everything okay, babe?" Stephen stood over them, blocking the aisle to prevent anyone from going past. There were no available seats. "Babe," Lyle scoffed. She nodded her head back, darting her eyes to the P-car part of the train. Other passengers started to notice. They shook their heads. Lyle was doing this for them, for the public good. "So you're not going to move?" Lyle said nothing. Hunching over, she grabbed her bag and slammed it into Lyle's lap, bursting the coffee cup. She kneed him in the thigh and, stepping over him, elbowed him in the face twice, stomping on his foot. "Get out of my fucking way, you fucking asshole!" Down the aisle. A pool of hazelnut muffiny warmth soaked his crotch. He dropped what remained of the cup to the ground. No job fair today, no rounds today. He picked up his attaché and put it over the wet spot of his lap. The bell dung and the train started to move. It got quiet, even though Lyle could feel his ears pulsing. "You," Lyle heard. "You, hey buddy, let's go." The conductor grabbed Lyle's shoulder. He was shorter than he looked from above. He did not look like a Marx brother. Maybe he should have given him his ticket. "Off my train. Next stop, move."
All right. That's annihilating. There were moments in there when, had I been in a cafe, I would have been laughing out loud, but I didn't want to overwhelm the recording here. It is almost time for us to finish the show, and you have to get to work today.
I do.
So is there a final point that you would like to make before we end the interview?
I jumped around in that chapter. It's smoother.
Mm-hmm. It's smoother than it was when you were in. Yeah, it always is.
No, the only thing I'd want to follow up with was thanks for doing this.
Well, thanks very much for coming in.
I appreciate it.
We hope to do it again. All right, best of luck to you and your career, Robert Duffer.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Liquid Sound on Morton College Radio. I'm your host, Gintaris. Liquid Sound airs weekly on Wednesday nights from 7 to 8 p.m. Download the Morton College Radio app to listen to Liquid Sound on your mobile device or telephone. Liquid Sound is produced by Michael Cott and directed by me, Gintaris. Liquid Sound is a series of conversations and discussions with contemporary thinkers and artists. As always, thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you, Finland, for tuning in once again. Have a great night out there, and I'll see you next week.